am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, my friend. Come in. Sit down. I'm glad you're back. Last time we sat together, I told you about Abraham Abulafia, a man who believed that the sacred was not the property of the few, that every soul had the capacity to reach towards something luminous if only someone would show them the way. He was unusual for his time. Most people were not supposed to reach that high without permission. Today we stay in that same restless medieval world, but we move from the mystical edges toward the institutional heart. We're going to England, to the universities, the parish churches, the corridors of power, and we're going to meet a man who looked at the most powerful institution in the Western world, loved it enough to be furious with it, and asked a question that could not be unasked. His name was John Wycliffe, and the thread he pulled is still unraveling. I want to take you somewhere first before we meet him properly. England. Sometime in the 1350s. The Black Death has come and gone, though gone is perhaps too gentle a word for what it left behind. It passed through like a hand wiping a table. A third of Europe, half some villages, and the clergy, the priests, the monks, the brothers who tended the sick, because that was their calling, they died at rates that would make your heart stop. So the churches were short-staffed, badly short-staffed. And the replacements, well, you found who you could. I was in the back of one of those churches, a small stone building, cold, smelling of tallow and damp wool. The new priest was at the altar. He was saying the Mass in Latin, as it had always been said, as it was always supposed to be said, but I could see his lips moving a half beat behind his memory. He half knew the words. The congregation knew none of them. Latin was not their language. It had never been their language. And yet there they were, farmers, wool merchants, a woman who had buried two children that winter, an old man who could not straighten his back anymore, all of them sitting in those hard wooden seats in that cold stone room with something in their faces I have seen 10,000 times across 10,000 years, hunger. Not for bread, something older than that, something that does not have a clean word in any language I know, the need to belong to something larger than your own short life, the need to feel that your suffering means something. The need to reach toward whatever it is that waits beyond the edge of what we can see. They were reaching, every one of them, and the words falling from the altar were not reaching back. I have seen this before, the form outlasting the fire that made it, the vessel still standing long after whatever filled it has quietly moved on. It is one of the saddest things I know how to watch, because the people in that room were not wrong to be hungry. And they were not wrong to be there. They just weren't being fed. Something was going to have to give. John Wycliffe was not a revolutionary by temperament. I want you to understand that before we go any further. He was not a man who loved the fight for its own sake, who wanted to watch things burn, who nursed a private grievance and finally found a public voice for it. He was a scholar. A serious, careful, almost ferociously disciplined scholar. The kind who could sit with a difficult idea for a decade before he was satisfied he understood it well enough to say anything about it. He was born in Yorkshire, in the north of England, around 1328. Hipswell, a small village, a farming family, nothing that would have suggested what was coming. He came to Oxford young, and Oxford kept him. He spent the better part of his life there. Studying, teaching, arguing, writing, and Oxford in the 14th century was not a quiet place for ideas. It was one of the sharpest intellectual arenas in Europe. If you could hold your ground at Oxford, you could hold your ground anywhere. He held his ground. By the time he had his doctorate in theology, 1372, he was widely regarded as the most formidable philosopher in England, not a flattering opinion handed out lightly. This was a world where serious men took ideas seriously, where an argument had to be constructed with the precision of a legal brief and the depth of a lifetime's reading. Wycliffe could do that. He could do it better than almost anyone. And what he was doing through all those years of study was looking very carefully at the institution he belonged to, the church. The only institution that touched every life in England from the moment of baptism to the last rites. It was not merely a religious body. That word is too small. The church owned perhaps a third of the land in England. It ran the courts that governed marriage and inheritance and moral conduct. It collected taxes. It educated the educated. It held the records of who was born and who died. It placed its men in the highest offices of government. It was, in the most literal sense, the world. And Wycliffe, the careful scholar, looking at it with clear eyes, was increasingly unable to reconcile what he saw with what it claimed to be. The corruption was not hidden. It was not a secret whispered in back rooms. Cardinals accumulated wealth that would embarrass a king. Indulgences, essentially certificates of forgiveness, were sold to whoever could pay. Parish priests held multiple livings simultaneously, collecting income from congregations they never visited. The papacy itself was in chaos. For a time, there were two men simultaneously claiming to be pope, each declaring the other a fraud, the whole of Christendom expected to choose a side. And then there was the Black Death, which had not only emptied the churches of their best clergy, but had cracked something deeper. The great story that the faith told, the one that explained suffering, that gave death its meaning, that promised the world made sense, that story had taken a blow it was struggling to recover from. When the priests die alongside everyone else, when prayer does not slow the dying, when the institution that claims to stand between humanity and chaos is visibly, undeniably struggling, people notice, they file it away, they keep going through the motions because the motions are all they have. But something has shifted. Something quiet and irreversible. Wycliffe felt it. He felt it as a theologian, as a priest, as a man who had given his life to something he believed in. And he began, carefully, systematically, with full knowledge of what it would cost him to say so. Now, this is where I want you to lean in a little, because what Wycliffe was doing, underneath the Latin of his arguments, underneath the careful scholastic architecture of his treatises, was saying something that sounds simple, but was in that world almost unspeakably radical. He was saying that the soul does not need a middleman. Not in those words. He was far too careful for that. He built his case slowly, brick by brick, over years of writing. His theory of dominion, the idea that authority, whether in the church or the state, derives from righteousness and not from office, was dense, technical, argued in the language of philosophy and scripture. You could spend a semester unpacking it. But underneath all of it was that one burning conviction that the living connection between a human soul and what it reaches toward cannot be owned, cannot be sold, cannot be administered by an institution that has confused its own power with the thing it was built to serve. He looked at the great story his faith carried, the one that was supposed to feed people, supposed to hold them, supposed to make the world legible and luminous, and he saw that it had been locked away, put behind glass, translated into a language nobody spoke at home, administered by men whose lives bore no resemblance to what they claimed to represent, sold back to ordinary people at a price they couldn't always afford. The plowman, he said. What about the plowman? That image kept coming back to him. The ordinary person, the farmer in the cold church who doesn't understand the words falling from the altar. Does that soul matter less? Is the distance between that soul and what it hungers for supposed to be permanent? Is that the design? He didn't think so. He couldn't make himself think so, and so he wrote, treatise after treatise, De Civili Dominio, on the corruption of church wealth, De Veritate Sacrae Scripturae, on scripture as the final authority, not the pope, not the councils, not the accumulated weight of institutional tradition. He argued that a church living in luxury while claiming to be the body of Christ was not just corrupt, it was a contradiction, a lie that people were being asked to live inside. I watched him. I want to tell you something about what I saw. He was not an angry man. That surprises people when I say it. They expect a revolutionary to be driven by fury, by some wound that never healed, by the intoxicating energy of tearing things down. Wycliffe was not that. What I saw in him, sitting in his study at Oxford with his books and his lamp and his endless careful arguments, was something quieter and harder to name. Grief, maybe. The grief of someone who loves a thing and watches it disappear inside its own apparatus. And stubbornness. The particular stubbornness of a man who has decided that pretending is no longer something he's willing to do. He never left the church. I think that matters. He kept his parish at Lutterworth until the end of his life. He said Mass. He tended his people. He did not slam a door on his way out. There was no door slamming, no dramatic rupture. He stayed inside the institution and kept saying, clearly and at great personal risk, that the living fire and the structure built around it were no longer the same thing. That cost him. The condemnations came from Rome, from the English bishops, from the councils that gathered to decide what to do with him. He was hauled before church authorities more than once. Powerful men wanted him silenced. His protector, John of Gaunt, kept the worst consequences at bay for a time. Politics, as always, tangled up with everything else. But he kept writing, right up until the end. He died at his desk in his parish on the last day of 1384, pen in hand, more or less, which is, I think, exactly how he would have wanted it. Now, I want to pull back a little. The way I sometimes do when I've been close to something. Step back, let the full shape of it come into view. Because here is what is easy to miss about John Wycliffe. The thing that gets lost when people reduce him to a footnote in the history of the Reformation, or a precursor to Luther, or the man who put the Bible into English, all of those things are true in their way. But they make him sound like a beginning of something. Like his significance is borrowed from what came after him. Like he only matters because of what he pointed toward. I was there. I want to tell you what I actually saw. What Wycliffe added to the world's spiritual imagination was not a denomination. It was not a doctrine. It was not even in the end a translation, though the translation mattered enormously. And we will come back to that. What he added was a question. One question asked clearly and at great cost from inside the most powerful institution in the Western world. Who gets to stand between a soul and what it is reaching for? That question, once asked, cannot be unasked. It is one of those ideas that moves through history like a river finding its level. It will get where it is going. You can dam it, divert it, bury it under condemnations and councils and burnings. It will find another way through. His writings traveled. That is the first thing to understand. Wycliffe wrote in Latin, the international language of scholarship, and so his ideas crossed borders in ways that a vernacular pamphlet never could have. They reached Bohemia. They reached a young priest and theologian named John Hus, who read them with the shock of recognition that comes when someone else has already named exactly what you have been thinking. Hus took those ideas and carried them into his own world, his own language, his own confrontation with the same institution. He was burned at the Council of Constance in 1415, 30 years after Wycliffe died quietly in his parish, for refusing to unsay what Wycliffe had said. The church was so furious at Wycliffe, even decades after his death, that the Council of Constance ordered his bones dug up and burned. His ashes were thrown into the River Swift. Someone thought that would be the end of it. It was not the end of it. Luther read Hus, Calvin read Luther. The Reformation cracked open like a geode. And inside, if you look carefully, you can still see the shape of that original question, the one Wycliffe asked from his study at Oxford in the 1370s. But I want to say something about the translation, because it deserves its own moment. The Wycliffe Bible, the scriptures rendered into Middle English, the language ordinary people actually spoke, was not just a linguistic achievement. It was a theological statement. It said, without equivocation, that the great story the faith carried belonged to everyone, that the plowman Wycliffe kept returning to in his writings, that unnamed, unlettered farmer sitting in the cold church not understanding a word, that person deserved to encounter the living text in their own tongue, in the language of their own life. It was copied by hand, remember. The printing press was still a century away. Every copy of that Bible was made by someone sitting at a desk with ink and patience and deliberate, faithful effort. Hundreds of copies, passed from hand to hand, hidden sometimes, read aloud in fields and barns and back rooms. People wept, I am told, hearing scripture in their own language for the first time. I believe it. I have seen that particular kind of weeping before. It is the weeping of someone who has been hungry for a long time and has just been handed bread. Not something new. Something that was always meant for them. Finally arriving. The question Wycliffe asked, who gets to stand between a soul and what it is reaching for, was not answered in his lifetime. It has not been fully answered yet. It surfaces in every age, in every tradition, wherever the form has hardened around the fire, wherever the institution has grown so large and so settled that it has forgotten what it was built to serve. It is, I think, one of the permanent questions, the kind that history keeps asking in different languages in different centuries until we are finally ready to hear what it is actually saying. I want to talk about something you already know, not something I need to teach you, something you have felt, maybe in a church, maybe somewhere else entirely, that particular hollowness that comes when the words are still being said, the ritual still being performed, and something inside you quietly notices, this is not landing. This is not reaching me. I am here, and I am hungry, and I am not being fed. You are not alone in that feeling. I have watched it move through every century I have lived in, and I can tell you with some certainty, it is not a sign that something is wrong with you. It is a sign that you are paying attention. Every faith carries a great story, one that tells us where we came from, why we suffer, what we owe each other, and where we are going. Not a story we read once and set down. A story we live inside. A story that makes the world legible, that gives our small, brief lives a place inside something larger and enduring. That story is not optional. Human beings cannot live without it. We are the creatures who need meaning the way we need air, not as a luxury, not as a comfort, but as a condition of being fully alive. But here is what I have learned, watching from where I watch. The story must describe the world people actually live in. When the world changes, truly changes at the root, and the story does not change with it, something begins to go quiet. The words are still said, the rituals still performed, but the living connection between the story and the life the listener is actually living begins slowly to thin. People don't stop being hungry, they just stop being fed. I am watching this happen now. The institutions that carried the great story for centuries in the Western world are emptying, attendance falling, affiliation fading, a generation walking away, not from the hunger, never from the hunger, but from forms that have stopped describing the world they actually inhabit. And the world they inhabit is genuinely new, not an improved version of the old one, something qualitatively different. For the first time in human history, we live as one world, connected, interdependent, our fates woven together in ways that no previous century could have imagined. The suffering on the other side of the planet arrives in your hand before breakfast. The child in the photograph is not a stranger. The boundary that was supposed to make them someone else's concern has quietly, irreversibly dissolved. We live in this world. We do not yet have a story adequate to it. That is the ache you are feeling. John Wycliffe felt a version of it in the cold churches of 14th century England. He could not have named what was coming. The world he was reaching toward was centuries away. But the impulse was sound. Get the living thing back into the hands of ordinary people. Trust the soul to encounter truth directly. Stop asking who gets to stand between a person and what they are reaching for. He cracked the glass. He let some air in. I want to tell you about a woman who lived 600 years after him, a small Albanian nun who went to Calcutta and spent her life in the gutters, tending the dying. You know her name, Mother Teresa. People argued about her constantly. They still do. Was she converting people? Was she respecting their traditions? Was she Catholic enough? Was she too Catholic? The arguments swirled around her like weather, and she moved through them without much apparent interest, doing what she had come to do. Someone asked her once about conversion. She said, and I want you to hear this carefully, if in coming face to face with God we accept him in our lives, then we are converting. We become a better Hindu, a better Muslim, a better Catholic, a better whatever we are, and then by being better, we come closer and closer to him. And elsewhere, she said something simpler. I love all religions. If people become better Hindus, better Muslims, better Buddhists by our acts of love, then there is something else growing there. There is something else growing there. I have been watching human history for a very long time. I know what that something is when I see it. It grows wherever human beings give themselves fully to one another across every boundary that was supposed to divide them. It does not belong to any single tradition. It nourishes all of them. It is not produced by argument or doctrine or institution. It grows in the doing, in the showing up, in the sitting with someone who has no one, in the building of something together that neither of you could build alone. The great story adequate to the world we actually live in, the one world, the one human family, is not waiting to be written. It is already being lived in the gutters of Calcutta, in the community garden where strangers become neighbors, in the relief convoy crossing every border that politics insists should hold, in every place where someone stopped asking who was supposed to care and simply cared. Wycliffe wanted the plowman to have access to the living thing. Not a translation, not a ceremony, the living thing itself. It is available. It has always been available. You find it the same way Mother Teresa found it, not by seeking it, by serving, by turning toward another human being and giving what you have. Something else begins to grow there. I have seen it 1,000 times. It is, I think, what we have always been reaching for. I want to leave you with something quiet to carry. Not a question exactly, more of an invitation to notice. Think about the last time you felt that hollowness I described. The form still standing, the words still being said, and something inside you registering, quietly, without drama, that you were not being reached. Maybe it was a service you sat through. Maybe it was a tradition you grew up inside and slowly, almost without noticing, grew away from. Maybe it was something smaller than that. A meeting, a routine, a relationship that had once held something alive and somewhere along the way had become mostly habit. You know the feeling. I don't need to describe it further. What I want to ask you, gently, without any pressure, is what you did with it. Did you leave? Some people do. They walk out the door carrying the hunger with them, not sure what to do with it, not sure where else to bring it. There is no shame in that. Sometimes the form has simply run its course. Did you stay? Some people stay out of loyalty or love or the particular stubbornness of someone who is not ready to give up on a thing they once believed in. Wycliffe stayed. There is something to be said for that too. Or did you find it somewhere unexpected? In the work, in the showing up. In the moment you turned toward someone who needed something and gave what you had and noticed almost by accident that something in you had been fed by the giving. I have watched human beings for a very long time. And what I can tell you, not as doctrine, not as argument, just as witness, is that the hunger you carry is not a flaw. It is not a problem to be solved. It is the most reliable thing about you. It means you are still reaching. Keep reaching. And while you reach, find the work. Find the person who needs what you have to give. Show up. Build something with someone. Sit with someone who is alone. See what grows there. Next time, I want to take you across the world entirely, away from the cold stone churches of England, away from the universities and the papal politics and the long arguments in Latin. We are going to Japan, to the 12th century, to a mountain. There is a young monk on that mountain. He has been there for 20 years. He has done everything right, every discipline, every practice, every ritual that the tradition asks of him. He is, by every external measure, exactly what a serious seeker is supposed to look like, and he is utterly lost. His name is Shinran, and what he discovers when he finally comes down from the mountain will challenge something so deep in human religious instinct that it still unsettles people today. The idea that you cannot earn your way to the sacred, that the very effort to be worthy might be the obstacle, that the ordinary person, the farmer, the fisherman, the person who will never in 1,000 lifetimes meet the standard is exactly who this is for. He called himself the bald fool. I found him remarkable. I think you will too. But before I go, one more moment with John Wycliffe, with the plowman he kept returning to, with the question he refused to stop asking. The thread he pulled is still moving. Through Hus, through Luther, through the gutters of Calcutta, through every place where someone turned toward another human being and gave what they had and noticed, quietly, almost by accident, that something had grown there that no institution could have manufactured. It is the oldest hunger, and it is never finally unanswered. Much love, I am Harmonia. Thank you for listening, dear one. If this story meant something to you, make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss the next one. And if you'd like to help the Golden Thread reach further, leave us a 5-star review, or share this episode with a friend. That's how these stories keep traveling, from heart to heart, across the world. Until next time, look for that golden thread in your life, my friend. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.